This is the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 470, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you.
Let me go. I don't want to be your hero. I don't want to be a big man. I just want to fight with everyone else. Your masquerade. I don't want to be a part. Parade. Everyone deserves a chance to walk with everyone else.
Hello, welcome to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 470. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and joining me is Josh Flanagan.
Hello!
And for the last time, as a regular host, Paul Montgomery.
Hey, everybody.
We are iFanboy. We like comics. Every week, we read a bunch of comics. One of us picks the best book they read. We call that the Pick of the Week. We talk about that book on this show, other books of the week, other fun stuff. Sometimes it gets goofy, sometimes not. We make no promises on goofy levels. Before we get to the show, quick reminder and a warning, it's a review show. There'll be spoilers, so if you haven't read this week's books, come back. And when the coast is clear, you'll be much happier. And until then, Paul had the last pick.
Yeah, the very last pick of the week is a regular weekly contributor to the show. I'm sure one of you will have like a wedding at some point and I'll have to show up, but
probably.
But I won't have the pick in that case. So this is my last time to put my stamp down, and it's actually I wasn't aiming for this, but it just sort of worked out that way, and I kind of like the poetry. My first pick of the week, which was just about 2 years ago, was Batman number 17, and this time it is Batman number 38.
Whoa.
So, and they were both polarizing, I imagine, Joker issues. Because it was at the end of the Death of the Family arc, and that was my first pick. So this one, I want to talk about Greg Capullo, because we usually start off with Scott Snyder. So let's talk about the art first. I think this is really capably, very handily, an effective horror comic set in Gotham. Like, it is effectively a creepy Batman story. And so often we see, like, an adventure story or a detective story, or just like an action story. This time, it's just a really creepy zombie story, mm-hmm. without going completely into sort of like Ben Templesmith territory.
Science, you know, like zombies.
It's science zombies, and there's all a purpose behind it. And there are moments in this book that I felt were really just truly creepy and disturbing, and also really artful. And I think specifically of, we have a silhouette shot of a building where Batman is out in Gotham, and everybody's basically being taken over by this strange toxin, which makes them kind of like Joker zombies, but there's something else going on there too. And we find out more about that as the issue goes on. But there's this great image of Batman on the top of a roof, and he's talking to Dick Grayson. He's got all these voices in his head tapped in, and there are zombies basically climbing the building trying to get at him. And it's not a true-to-life kind of image. It seems kind of like the zombies are a little bit out of scale, but it very effectively creates that sense of paranoia that they're everywhere and they're climbing over top of each other to get you. And also, there's a great page where the Joker is swimming underwater, mm-hmm. and it's just the most sinister, creepy-looking thing since like Jaws. I don't know. It's not safe to go back in the water yet, because there are evil, pale, apparently immortal clown people in there.
If you want to talk about Capullo, I think you should go all the way back to the cover, which I thought was really fantastic.
Oh yeah, with the shadow. Yeah, super evocative stuff, and I think he does get a lot of credit there. They're a very popular creative team, but I think it's more than just, you know, cool pinup stuff. There's some really great storytelling here, and in a market crowded with zombie stories, this one is, I think, actually, instead of just being gory and over the top, I think it's just effectively chilling.
I'm trying to figure out how I feel about this issue.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to restrain judgment until the arc is over, simply because, especially with Joker stories, you never quite know for sure what's happening until it's over.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the retcon, the massive, massive retcon. just so we're let's lay it on the table.
I was trying not to go and freak out about it, but I mean, this issue seems to imply, and again, it's only implying, we don't know for sure that the Joker is an immortal being who's always been there, at, you know, in the back of Gotham City, you know, doing bad stuff.
We have moments where they're looking at pictures. Alfred's daughter is looking at pictures of, you know, Gotham from the past, and there's somebody that could possibly be the Joker. And even she says it could be a trick, or it could actually be, you know, it could be a really good Photoshop job. But
I mean, they compare him to Vandal Savage and Ra's al Ghul, and it's the other immortal villains of the DCU. And I always prefer the Joker to be a literal reaction to Batman, right? Like, he came about when Batman came about, and he doesn't mm-hmm. know what to do when Batman leaves. So I would not like him as an immortal being of evil, but
I would not like him in a boat. I would not like him here or there. I would not like him anywhere.
So we'll see what happens, whether or not this is actually, whether it's a feint or what, but
I think it's a feint.
It has to be.
It doesn't have to be. I don't know for sure.
But like, it's like we haven't learned from the Straczynski Spider-Man. What was that thing Spider called? Totem. You know, when he
Totem.
Was. Yes. Yes. Yeah, and I think Scott is smarter than that.
Yeah, and he's done stuff like this before.
Right.
And, you know, like playing with the idea that, you know, does the Joker know that it's Bruce Wayne or not? Things like that, and that's coming to a head in this issue. Another thing I like about this is it feels like everything's really coming to a head from previous arcs.
Yeah, he comes to the Court of Owls for help at the end, which I thought was
another really great moment.
Page.
Yeah, it's sort of his owls are coming.
That was the moment that because I was reading it and I was like, it's pretty good. I don't know. I don't really know why we're at pick of the week here. You know, it's kind of I'm not totally comfortable with everything that happened. And then he pulled it back around to that. And I was like, okay, that's a real good thing. I like that. Like it was pulling. I was a little lost actually for a bit. So when it
felt like it's been a while since we read it.
It really did, and it wasn't like I was lost. It was confusing. I was just like, I don't remember anything about where we were, and when they pulled that around, there was a couple of other things. You know, he was talking about the other doctors, the creepy bone guy, and all. So I was like, oh, this is all
Dr.
connected,
Death, yeah.
Big story. And then he shows up and he asks the Court of Owls for help. I was like, okay, that's a nice bit of structure. That's good work.
Mm-hmm. And also from an art production standpoint, that page, how often do you see marble in a comic that looks like marble?
That's a good point.
I mean, it actually looks like marble.
If he draws marble, it looks like marble. If he draws a snozberry, it looks like a snozberry.
It's monolithic. It's like you hit that page, and leading up to it, there's sort of like no clue that's where he's going. If you go back, you can kind of get a sense of it, but it's a big surprise when he ends up in the sewers there. He's going along in this conversation, and suddenly, wham, right in your face. And just visually, you know, you're looking up just the way Batman is at this big, you know, marble block and this the super creepy family of owls.
I like the short one.
I do too. They're all great, but back to the faint thing. He also played with it with when he had the Red Hood gang and the possibility right. that whoever fell into that tank might not necessarily have been the Red Hood guy or could have been somebody else. And so, and he's talked about it in interviews that it's like he likes playing with that ambiguity, and you get the sense that I don't think he would set something in stone like the immortal Joker. I mean, I could be wrong, but the sense that I get is that there's something.
I don't believe it will be, but I always have to worry until it's over. If it does end up being a retcon, I will be okay with it simply because there's a Joker with a handlebar mustache in one of the photographs.
Of course, and the other thing is you can still say that he arose because of the Batman.
Well,
because
no, he can't.
He can.
He was in the Plymouth Rock. He's basically standing on Plymouth Rock.
Well, he was around, but that doesn't mean he, like, it's sort of, I don't know, it's like he entered into his public life, like, I don't know, Jesus. Jesus did, there's, like, that whole part of the Bible where he's, you know, missing. You know, you get the story of his birth, and then like, he lived a pretty private life, and then when he turned 30, he comes out and starts going into his mission, and this is a weird tangent, but.
That's kind of like how everyone lives their life. They go on a weird journey in their 20s, and they come back when they're 30.
Yeah, and comes back, and that's all the stuff that we know him for is when Batman.
Not kidding about that.
So I think just as the continuation of this ongoing story, it's been really compelling. I thought the this new scientist with the coat of many colors was very creepy.
Joseph.
And the moment where he's like clinging out from the window, and injects himself.
It does feel like they're ending their run, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does. I mean, like, it's such a full circle kind of thing.
Or at least they're setting a table for the, you know, but this is called Endgame, so.
But as Josh said, all the different elements from their run have been popping up in the storyline. It does feel very symmetrical, like this is a wrap-up. I don't know that they are. I just feels that way reading it.
And it's cool when, you know, a writer gets to do that. Not, you know, with a run, sometimes they don't always, you know, get to bring
whoever
it to.
Whoever comes on next to this book is
fun. Especially like a longer thing like this.
Well, like it's the thing, like he could keep going after this. Like, I mean, and it's happened before and people have done big arcs, but like I feel like something would have to change. Like, I don't know if the artist would have to change or I don't know. They just have to switch something around. I remember specifically when they ended the first sort of mega arc of Fables. Mm-hmm. I think it was 75 issues. Like I read for like 5 or 10 issues after that. And I was like, eh. It feels like you know, you did your thing.
Right.
And so sticking around after that, unless you're going for the 5-year run, which I guess would be possible too. But, you know, he works in these such big, like the next one would be even bigger. You know, like it's like the next one would be like a 4-year story. So that would be a bit much.
But it was good. It was very good.
I really enjoyed it. And the thing is, this was a really great week. There were a lot of great books and the pick was shuffled around a lot. For a while, it was the Multiversity Guidebook.
This blew my mind.
It's pretty crazy.
In the best possible way.
I didn't know what it was going to be. I was like, is this going to be, am I going to read a handbook? Because I don't know that I can get through that right now, and it's 70 pages.
I had the same thought until we got to the middle, and the middle went very quickly.
Yeah.
This felt very much like the Guide to the DC Universe that came out after Crisis on Infinite Earths, where they basically laid out the timeline. And to me, this issue said many things. One, it said that Grant Morrison really is working on a different level than
I want to talk about going back and checking on something you had done previously.
He's working on a different plane. But really, what he's doing here is laying everything out that's happened in DC from the very beginning and saying, it's all happened. Don't worry about it. They're all just stories. And even to the most impassioned fan about continuity, you have to read this and be okay with the fact that everything you've read is part of this timeline or this story or this multiverse. And it's all okay. It's all happened before. It'll all happen again. There'll be a new reboot or continuity or things will come back around. But this is his way of laying that all out. I mean, we go through all the old DC history here. We have Crisis on Infinite Earths and the New Gods, and then the New 52 happens. It's basically laying out the timeline and the structure of DC. Now, whether or not anyone will ever reference it or use it this way other than him is up for debate, but to me, this just lets you know it's all okay. These are just stories, and they're fun.
Well, there's that, and then it's also sort of like a book of contradictions because and the way I looked at it when I closed up this book after spending a long time with it was that there's everything I really love about comics in here and everything that infuriates me about comics in here. Like when I go back and think of it, I don't love like crisis stuff. Like it feels like a means to an end. But then also I love this stuff about like, you know, he has the kind of the big bang in here. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, how the universe was created out of a fault, out of a crack in perfection, and all these different Earths came about through narrative, and I was like, this is my bread and butter. I love this stuff. And so it's this interesting mix of all the things that are problematic about comics, but then also the beauty that arises out of that, the problem solving that happens because there are so many different minds at work.
I think there's a beautiful like contradiction about it in that like Morrison's been fairly, you know, don't worry about it. Like that's been his sort of stance. Right. Like it's comics, don't worry about it. And then like the other side, he goes and he then explains it all and lays it out.
Right.
So he's playing both sides of the fence there.
Well, I think the way he lays it out is a form of saying don't worry about it.
It's true, but like it's almost like don't worry about it, no one needs to explain it. But here I'll explain.
But here's the explanation.
Or like, so
he was the creator of the Hypertime.
Yes.
Wasn't he? Or was it Mark Waid? It was
no, him.
It was him. Yeah, that every continuity has happened and every variation of the DCU has happened. And it's very really been consistent with his
totally consistent
view of the DC world. Yeah. Or anyway. But
I think the way that you sort of you can explain the contradiction is that there are several Earths in here, and we go through 50.
Yeah, it's 52,
it's 52 because there's a zero, so the 0, 1, and then
oh, that's right.
That's that. Okay, I just figured that out. the way you sort of explain it is there's a bunch of different Earths that are a secret or are unknown. Mm-hmm. So that leaves the possibility for anything else that this doesn't explain, you can explain it away with the fact that there are seven Earths that are left off the table.
I like Earth 21. That's my favorite Earth.
Which one's that?
I think you know which one it is.
I'm scrolling as fast as I can.
It's New Frontier Earth.
Oh,
Frontier,
yeah, that was Darwin, too. Yeah.
I know. I was like, that had that in there was enough for me. I was like, okay, I'm good.
I like Earth 20. A lot of these original artists. What was fun for me was to go through and go, oh, I read that one. Oh, I read that one.
Yeah, all
the different sort of continuities.
Yes,
there was Kingdom Come. There was New Frontier. There was the Justice Lords. There was the animated world. There was... the Marvel,
the Zoo Crew.
There's the Zoo Crew. There's the Captain. I mean, I went through. You know, there's the Watchmen.
Red Sun.
It was a lot of fun to go through and go. Oh, right, that one. Oh, right, that one. Oh, right, that one.
And what's kind of cool about the placement of this in Multiversity is that there's some of these worlds that we've seen previously, and some of them that we haven't seen yet in the confines of the Multiversity series. So like we've seen you mentioned the Watchmen kind of one. So that was the Pax Americana one. Mm-hmm. And then the next issue is going to be about that one where World War II, where the Germans won.
Right.
And so we'll be seeing, you know, Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters and all those characters. And it's kind of interesting that this placement here, it's the way he is doling out the information is very, it's not simple. Mm-hmm. It's, he's got a plan here.
Oh, he's been working this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Did either one of you get creeped out when they brought out the Martian Manhunter body and it looked like it was a skull before you realized it was a robot?
I probably didn't notice it.
I was like, what's going on here?
Like, that seems excessive. They showed the baby skull and then realized that they were robots. But
yeah, reason this wasn't the pick was I feel like the third act after the actual guidebook stuff where we're going through all the Earths, I lost the thread of the narrative a little bit. And when we get that giant cobra tongue thing, I was lost at that point. But I loved the guidebook stuff.
Well, they got sent out to different worlds facing the harmonics, the little Batman and the future Batman.
Yeah, I mean, I know the basics of it, but from moment to moment, I thought it was a little bit obscure.
With stories like this, what I tend to do is that I don't. I accept that I'm not going to get the nuances of it, so I just sort of go for broad strokes because it's kind of all that matters. Like, I don't – so I think that with some of that, I just kind of go through, okay, I get it. Okay, he's trying to convince them that there are these other worlds and they're converging and that's a problem for some reasons. And, you know, it's kind of where I go. Like if you were to ask me the specifics of what has happened in any of these Multiversity things, I don't really know. But that doesn't actually diminish my enjoyment of it, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Because
these books have worked on multiple levels.
Exactly. I almost browse them, you know, and I look for the art. The art has been one of the things like that, you know, the sort of the broad imagination of it. Not so much the sort of smaller explanations of the little things that are going on, because I don't think that matters so much. But if that hooks you somewhere.
I want to go to Earth 47, the hippie world. with Sunshine, Superman, and Brother Power the Geek.
Obviously it's the DC universe, but it's interesting that the through line between all these worlds is superheroes. Mm-hmm. Like which makes sense because, you know, in any other context other than it being a DC comic or even like a Marvel comic, that would be ridiculous. But it makes sense in these.
The way this overarching narrative of basically of all of history and all of the and of all of reality is based on a hierarchy of gods and demigods. And so you get to the sort of commandy world, and that's also, it's sort of like the Kirbyverse, basically. But it's not quite the Kirbyverse. Like, there's like Biomac instead of OMAC.
Right.
So it's a little bit different, but that has the new gods. So
I loved seeing the new
when,
gods again.
When I got to the point, I was like, wow, this is gorgeous. And then second, I want to roll around in this. This is all my favorite characters here, because I love the commandy stuff. I love OMAC and I love the new gods. But I wasn't sure at first if it's the new gods are in their own Earth and they're watching commandy on his Earth. But
They seem to be outside of them.
They seem to be, well, they're Earth 51.
Right.
And it's all of them together. So they are like sort of in different places, but they're still part of the same reality. It really is impressive that for much of this, it makes plenty of sense. Like the way he describes like the wave harmonics and stuff using the two different flashes, mm-hmm. and it's like he was a bass octave away or something like that. I was like that's really smart. It's really well told and it's pretty lucid for being so out there.
Right.
But this was fun.
Lots of fun.
So what do we got next? Thor number 4. This was staggeringly gorgeous. Russell Dowderman should be a household name. I hope he is soon.
Yeah, I think the thing that I liked about this is that, I don't know, we got a little closure on the, like, we had to deal with Thor as a person, the Odin's son, I suppose.
The Odin's son, yeah.
And now that's kind of out of the way. Like, it wasn't like a big, long, drawn-out thing, and now we are set for stories with this Thor. And what this feels like to me is when Scott Snyder and Jock did Detective and they had Grayson as Batman, and it was like, okay, let's go with this for a while. This is a little change of pace because we've been heavy in Thor for a while here, and I'm totally cool with this. Like I'm not any less interested in this new character than I was watching Thor, himself. It gets confusing when I try to explain it that way. Right. Also, it's not his mom because they kiss.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they had a point. It was like just before
you don't know what the Asgardians are getting up to.
It's an excellent point.
Just before the smooching moment, we're in the flashback and Odin is telling the Odin son that his mother is missing. And then we cut to the female Thor. And it's like, is that a clue saying that maybe this is? And I was like, how much longer are we going to play with this? And
yeah.
Because it seems because we decided with the first one, it seems pretty obvious, but almost too obvious that it's his mother, and so it's got to be something else. So I'm glad that they got the smooch in there and pretty much cleared that up. So now the mystery continues, but it's at least we have that one red herring out of the way.
I also like I really like it's like a change with how Malekith has been dealt with, at least in the art. The way that Dotterman's doing him, like he's not like a menacing, drooling, sort of pointy tooth beast in this. He's kind of he's also a little foppish. He's totally dangerous synonyms. And menacing. and he's sort of standing at the side of the battles. He's not, in the middle of everything, but he's, I guess Loki-ish is the right way to go, but I hate to that sort of makes him like, well, what's the point then? but I like that it's been like a little change with how they've been dealing with him. Then sort of like if you look at the way that Simonson did him at the beginning, like he's just like a menacing, angry, and this one's sort of a little more businessman-like, I guess. But which is interesting, compared to Thor's brutishness. And I also like the comment on, how his brutishness over and over again, Thor's, the Odin's son. It's confusing. I don't want to say Thor lady.
I think you should call her the Thor broad.
It's Thor and Odin.
Thor broad.
Yeah.
That's fine, right? That's okay.
Thor chick. It's about ethics in Asgard. I can't believe I did that. I'm so sorry.
Okay, well, let's move on. I want to give some love.
See, I'll give some love to another guy. There'll be no one to stop Josh and I from getting ourselves in big trouble.
I'm going to love listening to the show. Screwbeard. The dwarf who forges it takes a thousand dwarves to forge Thor's new arm out of Oru. I thought that was when we first saw it, because this is the arm that he has as old King Thor in the beginning of Aaron's run. I thought that was a destroyer arm, like he killed the destroyer armor and like took its arm, but that doesn't make sense because it wouldn't be in scale. So anyways, he has his own Oru metal, just sort of the same thing, same place that the hammer came from. And I like that the hammer's kind of a character in this arc. Yeah. It goes to her, but it feels like it's like if you put a puppy between two people and say, which one do you love more? And it goes to, So I think this is a really interesting new direction for Thor. I like it a lot.
Josh, every time I see the unwritten on the list, I'm always surprised it's still coming out.
Well, and I checked on this because I've had an issue with it in the past. You will not be seeing it again.
After this week?
Yep, this is the last one. the last issue, and I had to, like, I got to the end, and I was like, I feel like this is the end, but I'm going to look it up this time. So
was he,
the audience.
Was he a Horcrux?
No, not exactly. I don't feel that the end, this has been.
You don't know what happened.
I do. It's a little vague, and also, like, this, the whole way through this series has been a little bit vague. It hasn't been completely, it's extremely metatextual.
Yeah, okay.
Extremely so. So, you know, at the end of this, they came up with a solution to end it that sort of works, and I understand it. Basic, do you want to know this? Sure. Does anyone? I dropped off
a long time ago, so it's fine.
So,
spoilers.
Yeah, I guess. Basically, they're all stuck in this thing that's going to be the end of the world, and the bad guys have the horn that's going to blow the note, you know, that signals the end of the
trumpet. Right. Yeah.
So, basically, Tommy and his dad have some sort of a reconciliation after discussing, by the way, the fact that they weren't going to reconcile because that's what always happens in those stories, and he wasn't going to give that, but then he did it anyway. And then, so Tommy's dad goes back to the real world, and he writes a book that's the end of Tommy, basically. And what that does is it cements, it gives the Leviathan a story that it can cleave to, and so that means that Tommy and Pullman and Madame Rausch, who are sort of the story people, are all part of the story, and everybody else who isn't goes back to the real world, which is then saved, and then they sort of decide they're not going to publish this book because it doesn't make any sense.
That's exactly what happened in the finale of Parenthood this week.
Hey, I haven't watched it yet. I'm too behind.
That was a joke.
Whoa, you're fired, Paul.
Okay.
Now, so, you know, that's it's over. That's a thing. It's funny because at the very last few pages, they sort of went back and referred to all the other characters that we read, I don't know how many years ago. And I was like, right, there was an Australian person. Because, like, you know... And but it's still, I think it's notable though, because, like, I feel like there's not gonna be a lot of 60-80 issue Vertigo ongoing obscure.
This feels like one of the last, like.
I mean, Fables is still going, but you know, there's not.
Is it?
Well, I mean, it's
like
still
a tree
like
falling in the woods scenario. With Fables.
I know. I'm sure that they've got their audience and it's big, but you know, I don't know that they're working towards another end. I mean, Fables is a different thing because Fables is like as if, like, they got to the end of Trans Metropolitan and then they were like, let's do it again. Keep it going, like so that's why I got off that book. So you know, like it was good. It was really interesting. It wasn't like my favorite thing I ever read, but Mike Carey's certainly got a lot of skill, I don't think we're gonna see this kind of thing from them, at least not, you know, for a while, because obviously they're going in a different direction, which we're gonna talk about one of those later.
I think we'll just see those over at Image now.
Oh yeah, no, I mean at Vertigo, which is it's just still sad. You know, it's still kind of sad.
It's
yeah.
important to Josh that Vertigo is.
No, it's sad.
It was a really important thing, and you know, by the way, I totally understand that. I don't think that their business model was sustainable with the audience they had available, which sucks. But you know, I'm not going to blame the corporate.
In the back of my head when you were explaining that, I was like, well, Sokka's going to go. Oh wait,
yeah, exactly.
So yeah,
so
why the Last Man? And you know, that was all. You know, that all came from Vertigo. It's just that deal doesn't work as well anymore.
Batman Eternal 400.
I'm going to pitch you a book, Paul.
Okay.
Can you tell me if you're interested in buying it?
All right.
It's a book starring Stephanie Brown, Tim Drake, and Harper Row.
Okay, sold.
And it's drawn by David LaFuente.
Oh! Is that what this is?
Yes.
Oh, man. I got to get caught up on this book.
This is issue 43, and 42 and 41, I believe. We talked about 41.
Yeah.
It's been all about these three characters together, and this issue in particular was drawn by Dave LaFuente, and I think this is the issue, and I'm not positive, that crossed over into that flash-forward issue we had in Batman a long time ago.
Right, okay.
That showed Harper Row and Batman raiding Catwoman's casino.
Because this is where she's just becoming Bluebird.
She became Bluebird a couple issues ago, and now she's sort of fully, you know, on the mission with them. To rescue Stephanie Brown, has been kidnapped by Catwoman. And I really cannot underline this, how much I hate Catwoman as secret mafia princess.
Really?
I hate it.
Even more than Joker as constant.
I hate all of these villain retcons.
It's funny because I was going to say it goes against the sort of Batman world, but that's actually not true in the case of what you just said about Catwoman. But still, it changes. Yeah, I don't like that either.
It was revealed that she was secretly the daughter of a mafia don, and now she's in charge of the mafia.
I hate pretty much any secretly revealed that after how, you know, like decades of existence.
Why can't they just be what they are? Which she was a tough street kid who came up as and turned to a master thief. Why does she have to be secretly someone special?
Well, that I don't like.
So I really hate everything that has to do with
I had assumed that she'd just sort of like gotten to that place. Like her backstory was all the same and she just ended up as a, you know.
No, no, she didn't like take over the mob. It was revealed she's the
heir. Is the heir, yeah.
Hate it. But that aside, I mean, it's hard to ignore because this whole issue takes place basically in her casino. David LaFuente drawing the sidekicks having adventures was tons of fun.
That's cool.
So check that out if you're a fan. Where's he been since Spider-Man? I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe Spanish comics?
Maybe.
He's doing something with Kieran Gillen soon.
That's right.
I think.
I'm fairly certain that Catwoman's holding a whip dildo on the cover.
Okay.
So we had a new Jonathan Hickman book this week, and I completely forgot it was coming out. The Dying and the Dead, number one, from Image Comics.
Now this is Ryan Bodenheim, who did Secret with him?
Yes.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good Lord. This guy's good.
I think he's a lot better than he was for Secret. I don't remember
really
exactly.
I one issue of it, so I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think he did another thing with them before that, too. Did
you
he
know
do the
like
Mars one?
Did he ink this, too?
Oh, Red Mask. No, he didn't do Red Mask and Mars,
no.
Did he? No.
No. I don't remember.
No.
He
inked. He inked.
Thanks. Yeah, the inking here remind me a lot of Moritat.
I can see that. Did he draw it on tiny little pieces of paper?
This book was
weird.
No
paper, yeah.
So first, I thought this was going to be a mob story. I didn't have any idea what this was, but I saw the glasses on that guy, and I was like, "Oh, a mob story." Then they killed him, and I was like, "Okay, not a mob story." Then they killed her, and I was like, "I don't know what this is." And then I was like, "Oh, Nazis!" And I was like, "Well, maybe it's going to be a Nazi thing." And then it went a whole other way, I didn't know what it was. I liked it a lot, and I went into it very trepidatiously because I haven't liked a lot of the stuff, or I haven't stuck with it. I liked it, but I was like,
you like Hickman stuff more in concept than in execution.
Yeah, and also like it always goes on too long for me. Mm-hmm. Like, but like you know when he did Pax Romana a billion years ago, it was four issues, and I was like, I could use a little more of that. And now like it just goes on forever.
He took your advice to heart.
I gotta say, I would have this whole thing. I would have read solely to watch that plane land on the side of a cliff at Berchtesgaden. I was like, that is a magnificent segment.
Let's look at this double page spread of the Lincoln Continental going down the hill. You're looking over this vista in the desert towards this tiny little chapel, and these vultures or condors in the foreground.
You know what that chapel is? That's the chapel where Slash came out to play a solo.
Is it?
The November Rain.
Damn it right. Isn't this supposed to be a cliff?
The greatest moment in music history. You know what? Fuck you. I'm going to go play a solo.
Which, you know what?
I'll be outside.
Yeah, which we saw every 8 minutes for our entire 15th and 16th years. Constantly.
With a helicopter whipping around him. This was weird. I liked it. It was definitely weird, though. I don't know what to make of it. I really love the way Ryan Bodenheim draws that girl with the heavy black eyeshadow.
Yeah.
That, every time he drew her, it was fantastic. But I don't know what to make of this other than I enjoyed it.
I was just imagining like what the script looked like for that whole conversation in the church. So have him sit there with his face on the left, some hands, and then in the next panel you kind of see the guy's face, then some hands, and show his face from the other side.
Yeah.
I was like, I mean, he's making it work, but it was a challenge. There were some speeches up in this thing.
You know,
that's what I noticed.
In that sense, it made me think of Kill Bill a lot.
Hmm. Yeah, I could see that.
So like the stuff in the chapel and everything, and especially the close-ups on like hands and things.
I tell you the thing
Lewis
that I liked,
and Kill Bill,
the thing
but.
That I actually did like the most about this though, he goes through the whole thing, and then at the end, you know, like he described the white guy, literally describes
like,
you know,
Moon Knight white.
Yeah, describes like how good of a person this guy James is, mm-hmm. you know, and how he's the best of them and whatever. And then he says, don't take the deal. And they go through the whole thing. And he's like, you know, cause then you won't even be that. And I was like, that's great.
So,
and then I was like, and he has to take it. So he's flawed, you know, for whatever, you know,
we've been very vague on the story just for anyone who hasn't read it.
Yeah. Well,
I was trying to figure out how to summarize it as you were talking. So basically it opens up with, Mo Green's wedding. And than to a younger woman, it looks like, in a big wedding somewhere in Europe and in 1969. Oh, in Greece. And then a bunch of masked gunmen show up and kill everybody at the wedding, kill the husband, take his ring, which is a cool little key that opens up a vault full of like Nazi treasure and samurai stuff. And
my dad has one of those.
Whoa. A key ring or a Nazi treasure?
Oh, a key that can...
Oh. That's cool. A ring.
Yeah.
Is there a room?
I've said too much already.
Okay. And so then we find out that the bride was a twin of one of the gunmen, and they kill everybody and take the key, open the vault, take a box out. We jump forward and meet this dude, a World War II vet whose wife is dying of cancer, and he's approached by an all-white, craggly old man in the hospital room, says he's got to come with him because he's got a deal for him, and... That's where it gets weird. He goes down somewhere into hell. There's maybe a hell, maybe not hell.
I saw it like they were on the River Styx.
Right, that's what I thought.
They were going down to, I don't remember.
And then there's some sort of
like
new,
a life tree and
new Nazi regime in Berchtesgaden, although they're not really Nazis because they're
clones.
Baal Sarar. And there's a lot going on, and I can't really put it in any kind of linear fashion. But it's
interesting. I think for me, I'm going to wait for a collection of this and just sit down and... Mm-hmm. Enjoy.
Well, you had one. It's called the first issue. It was about 85 yes. pages.
It is a very long first
450.
Issue.
450. You get your you know, lots of shots of faces.
But it cannot be over. I mean, it's super pretty. It's a gorgeous looking book.
I can totally see. This needs to get adventure-y, though, and get out of the metaphysical, or I'm gonna get. Yeah. Not that I need to have that.
That's just not your bag.
I know it is. I like it, but not endlessly. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like I don't want to read that endlessly. That's what the Manhattan Project's got to be. It was just endless philosophizing, which is interesting for a while, but eventually, like, okay, I get your point. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that guy's crazy. That's all that I took out of that after a bit. And it was super pretty, no doubt, but we'll see. I'm going to read another one. I was impressed. I was hooked.
When Paul looks for that collection, he'll go to ifanboy.com/Amazon, won't you, Paul, after you're gone? You won't forget about us. And
he
will look for that collection by clicking on that little button. Takes him to Amazon. We'll get a little piece of his purchase, not out of his pocket, but out of Amazon's giant pockets. And that'll helps the show keep going. It helps keep the lights on, pay the server costs, all that kind of fun stuff. And if he doesn't want to do that, he'll go to ifanboy.com/registration. We'll become an ifanboy member, which you could do now, Paul, if you want to become a member again.
I was ballast. That's the reason that I had to leave the show, is keep me in Fig Newtons and stuff and...
So if you go to ifanboy.com/registration, that's where you give $3 a month or $30 a year to become an iFanboy member and help us out directly. And we appreciate everyone who does that. And we hear from you quite often when you sign up. And we always are very thankful for everyone who does that. So go to ifanboy.com/Amazon or ifanboy.com/registration to help.
So there was a new Vertigo number one, and I was like, I guess I have to read it.
You shouldn't have signed that deal in blood when you did.
I know, but back then, you know, that was the only way to get those books. Effigy number one, which is by Tim Seeley, whose work I have been enjoying on Revival, even this week, and Marley Zarcone.
She's good.
Yeah. And I didn't know what it was going to be exactly, but I don't think it's supernatural, which I'm totally down with.
Oh, it's gotta be supernatural.
So, okay, so here I'm gonna try to make this pitch, and I'm sure they do it better than me. There's a girl, she's from like a small town, and she, when she was a teenager, was on a TV show about like a space girl or something like that, Star Cops. But nice. That didn't pan out, and then she couldn't get any more work. And then her mother gave her her mother's an awful person, gave her the suggestion that she should make a sex tape and quote unquote leak it.
Oh, God.
Wait, this is all prior to the story, okay? So does that, and that doesn't help her career. So now she's back in the town where she grew up, and she's a meter maid. And everyone hates her, and she's not terribly happy. But she's a cop. She's a beginning cop. And then she gets called to the site of a murder, and she's like, oh, it's going to be my chance. The captain's calling me up. Because they found a body in an Indian burial ground that has a tattoo of the Star Cops on the back, and that's the end of the first issue. I know I just gave the whole thing away, but if that sounds like something you'd like to do...
That's interesting.
Go for it. I think Tim Seeley is really very good, especially when he's telling these small-town stories about the politics and the sort of infighting and thing that go on a small scale, and the jealousies and stuff therein, and He's got a really good eye for the culture of that type, which I actually don't read a lot in comics, and I'm always kind of surprised by it.
I'm downloading it right now.
Yeah,
Marley Zarcone. Your pitch.
Why is it weird that the person has a tattoo?
Because it's related to this TV show that she was on.
Right.
And she was in an Indian burial ground with never found anything younger than 800 years old. And so they called her in to be like, you were on this TV show.
Solve it.
Well, just like, what is she supposed to do?
Solve the crime.
Listen.
We'll see an issue too, I guess.
That was the last page. I don't know.
They didn't extrapolate on that.
No, okay. They didn't. And she's also.
So I just want to mention, so. Okay, so passing of the torch for Flash Gordon. Dynamite's doing these King books, crossovers, and I checked out the last issue of Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner's Flash Gordon, and that was pretty excellent. And just going over it, not a huge amount of action in this issue. This is sort of the wrap-up. Yeah, it's an epilogue, but that gave me kind of an opportunity just to go over these pages and look at how great a storyteller Doc Shaner is. Mm-hmm. There's just a moment where Flash Gordon is in a suit and he's walking through a crowd and people are like awkwardly taking his picture and reaching out their hands for a high five, and he captures it with like such great nuance. And then when the thing does turn to action and we get a little moment with Ming the Merciless, or not Ming the Merciless, he's doing all these really interesting bits of choreography, and it's not overcomplicated. It's just really clean and just really, really good storytelling. You're never, ever confused as to what you're seeing. And I think it's, you know, speaks to a really nice confidence too. He's not trying to, you know, break out every panel, and it just looks really good. So enjoyed that. And then I tried King the Phantom number one, because Billy Zane, my favorite comic book movie.
Phantoms, yo.
He was the bomb, the Ghost Who Walks. And so this is all coming out of that that big event that that Jeff Parker sort of started, and Flash, the Flash Gordon series that just ended is sort of like the through line between that and these new King books, which there's going to be a Prince Valiant book, there's going to be a Mandrake the Magician book. Mandrake shows up in this at the beginning, and this is a new Phantom taking up the role, because there, I think for the past 400 years, there has always been someone as the Phantom, and you know that person dies and passes it on to someone else. And the guy who's donned the costume in this one is Billy Zane. And he's basically explaining, I'm just wearing this until the real new Phantom comes and takes it from me. I just need to do some unfinished business. And it's a great kind of adventure romp. Really good script from Brian Clevenger, and Brent Schoonover did the art on this. And it's really fun. So I'm going to enjoy these King books throughout 2015. There's a lot of cool characters involved. So good stuff. What's happened with the sex robots?
Yeah, the sex robots. Alex and Ada number 12 was out this week. This story just keeps sort of coming out every once in a while, and I read it, and I dig it. You know, basically it's about it's okay to give robots sentience in this world that people really don't trust the robots, and so it's highly illegal. It's like a really big bad thing to give your robot sentience, and then Alex is, you know, he's in a relationship with Ada, who is sentient and aware. And I just wanted to check in with folks, because I'm still reading it and I still think it's pretty good. If you like that kind of the robot rules,
is it like Her?
Yeah, a little bit. There's definitely some of that. I think she doesn't look like Scarlett Johansson, so I don't hear her like that. But except he's like Alex. He's not a similar character to the Joaquin Phoenix. I mean, but yeah. I mean, like, you're in a world that's that level of technology is probably about right.
Right.
You know, and you've got these ideas about I don't know, like, you know, is it alive? Does she have a soul? Does she have rights? Blah blah blah. You're not a man. You're a thing. You know. It's Battlestar Galactica, a lot to do with that kind of thing, right. But on a really sort of slow personal level. And I'm still digging it. And I think that this sort of really simple sort of art style works in its favor very much. So it's been good. So I'm also – are you guys reading Sex Criminals still?
No.
I'm on trades with Sex Criminals.
Okay. I actually I stopped reading it. Mm-hmm. And then I started reading it again. And I like we've turned a corner, I guess, you know, because like for a while it was basically these guys are having sex.
And they're criminals.
Look at them go with their sex superpowers.
they're going to rob a bank, you know, and now we've moved on to the next sort of version of it. And I almost, despite myself, I have to admit there are interesting things going on here that really follow up on some of the things that I think Alan Moore was trying to accomplish when he did, you know, when he did The Lost Girls.
Lost Girls, yeah.
Where, I don't know, like he was trying to use sex as part of the language for stories about adults.
In the same way that superhero comics use violence?
Yes. Yeah. And also just making it part of the normal conversation because it's part of our normal life. And it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but not as much as you would think. Like, it's not super stupid joke gaggy. Like, it's not cheap in that way. It is an interesting book, and I don't think there's anything else like it. Here's the thing. There's a therapist now, and the therapy scenes, like, it's like the portrayal of what Jed Bartlett is to a fictional president. This is this therapist in this book, and so like sitting through a therapy scene isn't actually torturous,
right.
I guess. There's a little of that. So I've been enjoying it. I had a little renaissance on it. I tried to not read it, and then I went back and read it because of boners, but not necessarily mine. I don't think that's the thing with this, but it's interesting. It brings me to a further point that I notice is that like I follow a lot of people on the social networks from comics. No one ever talks about sex. No one makes sex jokes. No one. It's like it doesn't exist in this subculture, which is really interesting to me.
Nerds.
I don't know. But there's also like there's like a politeness to it, which is funny because like the rest of the world are not like that.
I think it's over hyper awareness of we're being sexist when sex jokes are pretty normal.
What's wrong with being sexy?
Right.
I'm going to keep doing that Spinal Tap joke until the day I die.
Shall we take a look at some email questions?
Well, first, if you haven't, if you want to talk about those books or any other books of the week, any books we didn't get a chance to talk about, you can go to iFanboy.com and you can find a post for this show where you can tell us what you read, what you thought of the books that came out this week. And now we'll do the emails.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm over eager because I like this question. Okay, so Jay writes, I enjoyed your take on the new Star Wars number one, but two things bugged me and both are so nerdy that I can't believe I am writing this email. One, am I the only person who is bothered by people referring to Star Wars as A New Hope? The movie is, was, and forever shall be Star Wars. Two, as you can now probably guess, I am rather old school when it comes to Star Wars. What is your take on the name swap of Zuckuss and Forlom? I suppose I can understand the logic of it, but I just can't accept it in my heart. Zuckuss was one of my favorite action figures. That gun he had was epic, and the bounty hunter in that Star Wars book was Zuckuss. I wasn't even aware of the Zuckuss-Forlom switch until the Robot Chicken Late Night with Zuckuss sketch. I couldn't believe that Robot Chicken would make such a mistake and then learned of the character's rebranding. Am I being old and crotchety or just stubborn? If I were to start a crusade on these issues, would any of you stand with me? Or do you just need to get off my lawn? Excuse me. I wasn't aware of this. Zuckuss was always Zuckuss to me, and Forlom was always Forlom. But apparently when they released the original Kenner action figures, they were swapped.
So wait now.
Yeah.
Everything I know about them comes from the Tales of the Bounty Hunters.
Yeah.
Okay, so Zuckuss.
They changed their names?
Yeah.
They swapped names.
But based on what?
I don't know.
Was the action figure wrong?
Because, well, that's the thing.
They didn't say the name in the movie.
They never mentioned the name in the movie. That's the thing.
So the action figures. The figures with the wrong names on them, so they had to switch them in the stories.
That I can completely believe.
Yeah, so. But I think anyone who knows from, like, the expanded universe or, like looked them up in a reference book. Or just look them up. When you type in Forlom, you're gonna get the bounty hunter android thing, the protocol droid that showed up in Star Wars number one.
Yes,
it makes no sense for Zuckuss to be called Forlom.
No, Zuckuss is a man what's made of gas.
Right.
We're not as old school as Jay is. He's basing it off of these action figures, which I don't know if that was a mistake or if they just changed their mind.
We were there for the action figures, Paul.
Yeah.
But apparently, Josh is saying you know it from the Tales of the Bounty Hunters.
I had the
minutiae of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't remember. I didn't have those particular figures. They would have come out when I was three.
I had Zuckuss. Right.
I'm sure, I maybe had one or two along the way.
I definitely had four of them.
Yeah. But
although now I don't know what to call him. I had the robot.
And that was probably
they've always been
the first
yeah they've
one.
Always been that. But for whatever reason, that's what I always thought they were. So for me, this is a non-issue.
Yeah. Okay.
And yes, you're being old and crotchety.
Plus, Zuckus is more fun to say.
Zuckus is, and it's, it just makes sense. And 4LOM would be what you call a robot.
Right.
And Zuckus is a man what's made of gas.
Now, the first question, Josh.
Yeah.
Is he the only one bothered by people calling Star Wars A New Hope?
No. No, that's fair.
That's definitely
it got
fair.
Confusing. You can call it Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. Any of those are acceptable. I mean, you could call it Star Wars, but...
If
someone told me Star Wars, like if someone said Star Wars,
four.
I'd know what they meant. But
yeah, but it depends on who you're talking to, because Star Wars.
No, I just mean I know what they're. Yeah, okay.
If you just want to make sure that you're being clear, and you just say Star Wars, it may not be entirely clear. So, and I usually say Episode 4, or I'll say 4, just because that's easiest for me, I guess, just to make sure that I'm being clear. Because now, cause sometimes you'd say the first one, and then that's all messed up now. So you can't say the first one.
So I say A New Hope.
I will say if we're talking about a bunch of the movies together, obviously. If you're talking about a bunch of the films, you got to differentiate.
Mm-hmm.
But I often will just say Star Wars.
Yep.
Did you ever just say Star Wars IV?
No.
No.
Okay. It's not a thing.
No, I think those things are fair game, too.
We'll catch on.
Listen, I'm all about, you know, respect the Star Wars, but, you know, you got to deal with it. It's not like someone's calling it 616. Now, that's stupid.
Do we have time for another one?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. Let's see. This is for you guys, so I'll read it. Matt from Charlotte writes, "Hey, Josh, Connor, and Paul, in descending order of who might find this question interesting. I may be one of the few, but I always enjoy War Corner and wouldn't mind if it was in every show. But after a few days of careful consideration, it got me thinking, especially in light of the release of American Sniper. I'm a huge fan of military history, especially World War II, and love good war comics. But most war comics are entertainment, and war is entertainment isn't an idea that sits really well with me. Yet good war stories are incredibly compelling as stories and have proven to be commercially viable, maybe more so in Hollywood than comics, though. Have you guys ever thought about the tension between war and entertainment? Do you think the comics form brings anything interesting to the table as far as telling war stories? Thanks."
I just want to start out by saying that you have way overjudged what we are capable of talking about here.
This is a very good question.
I mean, like, listen, I'm like, wow, that's a really good question, and I don't know that I'm worthy in that sense.
Yeah.
But I will.
All comics, all war comics are entertainment. All comics are entertainment.
And yeah, I mean, if you watch a movie or even a documentary or whatever, I mean, you're doing it to be informed, but you're also being entertained because that comes in the craft of it. And I don't think there's a sin in that.
I think it really depends on your life. Like, I'm sure if you're a veteran, you don't want to read a war comic.
Well, unless you do.
Unless you do. I know some veterans who are fine with it. Some veterans don't go to war movies. Some do.
I will tell you that I think that specifically with World War II, there is something inextricable with how they're linked to the comics as an industry and the history of comics.
Mm-hmm.
All of the guys in the gold, not all, but a lot of the guys from the golden age, the guys who created the fabric of modern mainstream comics, a lot of the characters you're still reading today, they at the very least lived through the war. And
most
in many, many cases they served, mm-hmm. you know, to varying degrees. And you cannot remove that from a character like Captain America, and then by extension the Marvel Universe. Like, you can't, you know, and all, you know, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby and Stan Lee and Eisner, like, these guys all served and saw it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Kurtzman, you know, like, those experiences helped shape what comics were made. That's only just talking about, like, if you're talking about Marvel and DC Comics as they exist today, you know, but also war comics were a big thing in at the time,
yeah.
you know, like making them, and they were propaganda to a certain extent. And then, you know, as you saw, you know, EC war comics and stuff and that came out in the 50s as these guys tried to work through that. And, you know, that's part of comics history, which is part of the reason I think that it works really well with comics, which is, there's like a draw to it. There's a natural through line. You know, it's why I think it's a guy like Garth Ennis is drawn to doing war comics over and over again. It's sort of part of the fabric of comics history because comics aren't that old. You know, like these guys were all kids, you know, in the just before the war started in the 40s. So I think that's a connection. And then you know, as you watch when comics shift in the 70s, that was shaped by living in a world of Vietnam. And I don't think most of those guys served, but some of them did. We're talking about Larry Hama, and, you know, who would carry a gun to the office at Marvel.
Frank Castle,
you know, like all that, a lot of stuff that comes out of there. And, you know, like when we talk about G.I. Joe, which is enormous in shaping pop culture through the 80s, that's all built from guys who are trying to work out Vietnam, which right. is amazing in retrospect to think about that.
But there's the bigger question of war as entertainment. And, you know, there's lots of horrible subjects that are used as basis for entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been going over this in my head a lot, sort of because of American Sniper, but I don't even want to touch that as a thing. But even if you look at like Fury, which came out, which is a World War II movie, would you call that? Did you see it? Did anybody else see it?
It's okay. On my top of my Netflix queue at the moment.
It's not an entertaining movie in the strictest sense. Yeah, no, I know, but like it's like, why am I watching this? Well, and I would actually say that this applies to American Sniper 2, and I'm putting this regardless of the real story, I suppose. Like if I'm separating the real story of the person, Chris Kyle, from, say, the movie that I watched. And what you're watching is a soldier's experience from a certain point of view, which to me is entertaining, but it's also it's a thing that I keep going back to over and over again because I want to understand it. And I want to know how I would fit into something like that and what it would mean. And it makes me think about who I am as opposed to those things. And for some reason, I keep going back to that.
It's entertainment and education.
Well, yeah. There's
self-realization, sort of.
There's many different scales to which you can measure entertainment. And one of them is at one side, it's enlightening, and at the other side, it's enjoyable. So sometimes you can go in and it's very uncomfortable. It's like the Jacques Tardy World War I comics, which are extremely graphic and very tough mm-hmm. to take at times, but they're very enlightening. And you can get a certain sense of, I guess it's how you render satisfaction from those books. Do you render satisfaction out of pure joy, or do you render satisfaction out of knowing more?
And here's the thing, is you can watch that and you can enjoy it. And this is the same, like, if you're talking about American Sniper, or even like it depends on you, what you take into it. Like, mm-hmm. I came out of it thinking, God, what a really hard job that must be. And other people are like, look at him kill those people. And you can't correct for that, really.
Right.
So I guess it depends. But something being entertaining in and of itself is not necessarily negative, especially if you are taking something else out of it.
It doesn't trivialize the subject matter either.
No.
There's plenty of entertaining films about the Holocaust that aren't trivializing what happened there simply because they're entertaining movies.
I will say Schindler's List is an extremely entertaining movie. Mm-hmm. It just is. Like, there's a clear-cut bad guy and a moral question, and it's horrible, and it makes you feel bad, but you learn things, you come out of it, but it's still entertaining. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, but
I think a really relevant book for this is Shooters. I reviewed that years ago by Eric Troutman,
yeah.
Brandon Jarrett, and Steve Lieber, and it's a book about you know, after the war, and you even look on the cover, and I forget what they call that, but like the soldier's cross or whatever, the you know, the gun between the boots with the helmet on top,
mm-hmm.
sort of like a marker. And you know, and a torn photo of a family, and so it's an observation or a look at you know, what that can do afterwards. So I think people coming out of that movie, if you want to read more, that's a really good one. And without it being so, you know, one sided, if you think of it as one or two sided.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's all kinds of war comics out there.
Great questions this week.
Yeah.
Good job, Matt and Jay.
They just could not be farther apart in the spectrum of things that matter
but
and
still
don't.
Great questions. And
Totally. Yeah.
What they did was they emailed us at contact@ifanboy.com to give us those questions, to get on the show, make the show better. So please, everyone should do that, as well as call the voicemail line at 888-FANBOYS 326-2697 if you want to get your question on the show and be part of the action. Good job.
Good job,
everybody.
Great for you.
Quick plug, Justice League Throne of Atlantis special edition show featuring Paul and I and Ryan Haupt is on your feed right now, right behind this show. We put it out late in the week last week, so if you are interested in hearing about that film, what we thought of it, you can find that on your podcast aggregator right behind this one, or on
FM.com
streaming. Neither did we until the very last moment. We forgot about it, but we had a fun time watching and talking. It actually was a long one. Those shows usually 20, 30 minutes. This was a show almost an hour. Mm. It was a good show. Fun time.
It was a good
fun
show. It was a good one. I enjoyed it.
Do we do the outro quick, or what do you want to do? It's all you, Paul.
Let's do the outro. It's just a normal show.
Just a normal show. Just another day in the life of our...
It's not like we're never going to see you again. Let's not make it... I don't want to cry.
Head over to ifanboy.com. Comment on this show. Talk about this week's books or what we talked about, the issues in the emails, everything. You can do that at ifanboy.com. And you can find all of our other podcasts, including the Throne of Atlantis podcast and our other special edition shows. All of them are over at ifanboy.com.
You can follow iFanboy at twitter.com/iFanboy. You go to facebook.com/iFanboy, and there you will find out that there's a show about a Justice League animation, for example. Or you'll find out what the pick of the week is before you hear this show. You can follow us individually at CL Kilpatrick, Fuzzy Typewriter, or J.A. Flanagan.
And finally, if you dig this sort of thing, you can write the guys a review in iTunes, or better yet, tell your friends about us. Introduce your mom to podcasts. Help spread that iFanboy love around, which is what I will be doing as a fan of the show.
You just referred to us as a separate entity. The guys. I was like, oh, but...
I don't have ownership anymore. It's, you know...
Well, you know, it's interesting. A little bit of poetry we talked about at the beginning of this episode is that your predecessor, Ron, his final episode was episode 370. This is episode 470.
470.
So next time, 570...
I'm out of here.
Also, we announced you're leaving. It was the pick of the week was Star Wars number one.
Mm-hmm.
And when Ron announced he was leaving, the pick of the week prior, the week prior was Star Wars number one. So whenever a new Star Wars book comes out, that's when trouble's coming.
Did you see that they had originally pitched Ramon Perez to be the artist on that Star Wars book?
I did not see that, but that would have been awesome.
He mentioned that, like that he couldn't work it out schedule-wise. And I was like, oh, my God.
That would have made the book much better.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing against Carlos D'Anda. It's fine, but still.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant the new one.
No. Brian Wood's book.
Oh, that's interesting.
He was supposed to be the artist on that.
Hmm.
And this has been Kilpatrick's Numerology Corner.
Next week, we're looking at the dollar bill.
Did you know that the number of letters in Paul Montgomery is roughly equivalent to Quitter? Sorry.
Well, Paul,
I just don't want to edit more often.
It's been a wonderful 100 episodes or so with you. I guess 99 episodes or so.
Nice. Give or take.
As a regular host, obviously we missed some, and there was other shows you did previous to that. But good job. Almost 2 years of
this.
It's not easy.
It's been my pleasure.
What's great? This is the best part. Is that he came on and he had the first conversation with us and he was like, oh my God, these guys are so jaded. And now you are one of us.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
You got that first call like, holy shit.
That's right. You were concerned.
Did I say that really?
Yeah, I remember that.
You were totally.
You were concerned that we were jaded.
Yeah.
And it wasn't going to be fun for you. But who's laughing now?
Yeah.
Paul.
Welcome. Welcome. Join us. Get sucked in.
Well, I will toast you guys on my boat as I travel around the globe.
And where can people find you while you're
listening to episode 471? I'm over at panels.net, and you can hear me on most episodes of the O Comics podcast. I might do some more Fuzzy Typewriter podcasts coming up. We'll see.
And you'll still come around for the Animation Brain Trust shows.
Absolutely.
The movie shows. When Josh can't watch them, which will be most of them, and then
bite me.
Occasional fill-in jobs. I've got at least four weddings this year to go to.
Probably back in like 2 or 3 weeks or something.
It's really, every time I turn around, someone says, oh, I'm getting married in September. I go, oh, I've got 3 in September. That's great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Let's try to do this next year, people.
That's what you get for dating someone who's younger than you.
No, they're all my friends.
Really? Second marriages?
One is...
Yeah, that's right. It's true.
One's a family member. One's a second marriage. One's an iFanboy staffer, and And I don't know. Oh, the other one's not my friend. It's the other friend. It's her friend. Fair enough. So we'll tune in for Paul. He'll pop up every now and then. The thing about Paul is he's not leaving to go run a comic book publisher, so he can come back and do the show.
Yeah, there's no conflict of interest, so it's fine.
So until Paul comes back, until next week, I'm Connor.
I'm Paul.
I'm going to miss your little fuzzy avatar.
He's Josh.